This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our week in review. We start with George Floyd. Protests against racism and police brutality continued throughout the country as he was laid to rest this week. Floyd's family has said they hope his death at the hands of police leads to widespread change.
I want justice for my brother, my big brother. Everybody knows who Big Floyd is now. Everybody going to remember him around the world. He's going to change the world.
For some in the Commonwealth, like community organizer Armani White, that means amplifying calls to defund the police.
So when we talk about defunding police, we're talking about investing in communities. We're talking about putting our money where our, you know, where our values are.
For Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, it means declaring racism a public health crisis and reallocating the city's resources to address it.
So we'll be backing this declaration with an initial investment of $3 million. That's going to be transferred from the police overtime budget to the Boston Public Health Commission.
So where does that put us now? And how much further do we have to go? Call us and join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How are you feeling about where we are as a country? About how we're addressing this issue in the Commonwealth? How have you been affected by events since George Floyd's killing? And what do you want to see done? Give us a ring. Now, joining us to talk about all of it is our Week in Review panelists. We have Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Thanks for being with us, Renee.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, welcome back to you too.
Thanks for having me.
So, Renee, Jim, for the past 2 weeks, we have seen protests, activism at the forefront in streets, online. Now we are starting to see changes. Minneapolis City Council votes to, quote, begin the process of ending the police department, end quote. There are growing calls to defund the police. Mayor Walsh's announcements today. So what to make of the arc from when George Floyd was killed on Memorial Day 2 weeks ago to now? Renee.
Well, I think if nothing else, it certainly says that protests work. I don't know that if people hadn't filled the streets nationwide, that some places would be reacting at all. I do think it's important to say, though, that City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo has been talking about making racism a public health issue in Boston for months, even before COVID. And so I wish the mayor had acknowledged that, but I'm glad that he finally understands what Councilor Arroyo was trying to highlight for the city and for his constituents.
Jim, today Mayor Walsh said he is going to reallocate a percentage of the overtime budget for the Boston Police Department to address racism as a public health emergency, to support Health and Human Services. Renee just said protest works. This wouldn't have happened before. It does seem like it would have been inconceivable even 6 months ago that we would have seen a statement like this from the mayor.
No, I agree with it. I guess I would say that $3 million reallocated from a budget is a small start on what needs to happen. I mean, I actually think the word defund is doing a disservice to some of the more intelligent conversations around this. I mean, if you think about what people are actually saying, who are thinking about qualitative different changes to policing, they're talking about reinventing policing. They're talking about some broad-based changes that may actually change the culture of the police. And I hope we get into this later on, but I mean, there's things like getting rid of the so-called qualified immunity protections that are there. I mean, you're talking about transparency of reporting. We're talking about a whole bunch of different things. And I think if we're just going to be reallocating $3 million, I mean, to be honest, it's about money and pushing money upstream to prevention strategies, to build community trust that's withered on the vine. But it's about a lot more than that. I think that the real focus of all of this should be on reinventing the way that we police.
So, Renee, there's a lot in what Jim said, and I'm going to add a little to it by playing some sound for you from Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. He's also former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP. He talked to us earlier this week, and it's on this question of the use of the term defund. He said that defunding isn't radical and not a new term for policymakers.
I think we get so concerned and caught up in the words, but defunding is not new for policymakers. It's a decision about whether you're allocating your resources properly, whether you need to move money to a place that it's more necessary and more needed.
And yet we have heard a lot of expressions of concern. Even I heard Boston City Councilor Julia Mejia in an article this week call into question whether it's effective to use this specific term, defund the police. What do you think?
I think the term is a problem. I think what happens with the term is people think that means that police departments are going to be shut down, and it means nothing of the sort. At least that's not the way I hear it. I hear it as Michael mentioned and what Jim was talking about. You're talking about resource reallocation. And that's what I think the mayor was trying to get at today, and also Police Commissioner William Gross. The same idea that you don't need the police to do every single thing in communities. Because we know, I mean, you know, we've had the evidence that when you send police on mental health calls, very often people end up dead. So wouldn't it be better to have a mental health professional or to have a social worker on those calls? Other cities have done this. Eugene, Oregon has a program they've had going for decades called CAHOOTS, which stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. And essentially it's doing just that. It's taking calls that are crisis management, that are wellness calls, and sending professionals, not the police, to those calls. And it's been very effective. They've been doing it for about 30 years. So when people are talking about defunding the police, what they really mean is taking away money from the police and putting them in other places in the community to help the community.
You know, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross actually said something similar today at a press conference about reexamining the role of police in communities. Here's that sound.
Quite frankly, what I've heard in the community is we wear too many hats anyway. A child doesn't want to go to school, you call the Boston Police. A child's on the bus being unruly, you call the Boston Police. There's an emotionally disturbed person in a home, you call the Boston Police. How many hats do you want us to wear?
And I want to note that the commissioner goes on to say the department could cut overtime by sharing responsibilities. So, Jim, you expressed, at least note of the relatively meager amount that $3 million is. What would hardcore reform, serious reform through budgeting that would get to what Renee was just talking about, what Commissioner Gross talked about, that would get us there?
It's a good question. The answer, and I don't have a number in front of me. I wish I did, Tiziana. I guess what I'd say is I completely agree with the commissioner. They wear far too many hats, and there are probably less expensive ways of delivering the services on a person basis, and it would allow you to actually expand the service by hiring more people to do that work. So I don't know if it's how much of a budgetary question this is. In my mind, to be honest, I really think about this as a need for a cultural change within the police. And one of the reasons I was pointing to qualified immunity, thinking about things like, when an officer goes rogue, who actually pays for that at the end of the day? I mean, making it so that actually either the police department itself, the union has to pay for it, so they're policing themselves. We're talking about transparency of how they, if people have, as happened in the case of George Floyd, the officer who killed him had a whole history there. I mean, there have to be ways to identify trends and make them transparent to the public to build trust, because at the end of the day, all of this is about trust. And if we cannot build trust between the community and the police, and part of that, I think, as Commissioner Gross said, he's right, they're wearing far too many hats, we're asking them to do too many things, I get that. But part of it also is we're going to have to get in there and interact with people in a very, very different way.
I want to get a couple caller voices, or at least one in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Sylvester on the line from Worcester. Sylvester, go ahead.
Yes. I believe from my experience, a policeman is supposed to be your best friend. And they said it goes like, the man in the blue is your best friend. But in the America, the man in the blue is your killer. And these kind of policing need to stop.
Let me turn it back to Renee Graham now for some reaction. What about this idea that police should be best friends with the public?
Well, I can certainly remember when I was in elementary school, at least a couple of times a year, we would have a visit from a police officer, and he was sort of officer friendly. And we were told that they were peace officers. I would bet you schools do not do that anymore. And I would also bet you that the attitude that the police had towards the public changed when they were no longer called peace officers and they were called law enforcement officers. They weren't keeping the peace anymore. They were enforcing the law. That's a cultural and an attitude change in the way that police officers are in communities. I don't know many people who feel relieved when they see police officers. They feel nervous, even if they've done nothing. And that's the wrong culture. That is not what police officers should be doing in communities. They should be part of communities. You know, protect and serve is supposed to mean something, and I'm not sure it does anymore.
So we have a little sound from a conversation we had earlier this week with Dan Linsky, former superintendent and chief of the Boston Police. He says he believes here in the Commonwealth, or excuse me, in Boston, police have changed. Let's listen.
I think you have seen attempts by police departments to enact reforms. I think we've come a long way. We certainly can go further.
So what else would the police need to do, Renee? I'm going to stick with you for a second longer here, in order to achieve the kind of trust that Jim was talking about before that call from Sylvester?
I think police departments have to get much more serious about accountability. You know, if you look at what happened in Minneapolis with Derek Chauvin, who's the officer who's charged with second degree murder in the death of George Floyd, he had 17 complaints on his record. Why was he still on the street? You know, now there are Minneapolis officers who are complaining and saying, you know, he doesn't represent us. But what were they doing in the meantime? You know, we've seen this happen time and again. We've seen officers who've been arrested for things they've done during the protest the last few weeks. And when they walk out of court, there's a line of police officers applauding them. What does that say to the public? You know, all that does is reinforce this image of lawlessness. So I think in some cases, one of the most important things the police could do is be accountable to each other, but also to the communities they serve. There's this horrible feeling that people have that if the cops do something wrong, they're not going to be punished for that. And we've seen that time and time again. We know that in many cases that anything an officer does in the line of duty, he or she is going to get away with. And that's a problem. I think that is the most important thing that has to change. I think there has to be a sense that the police are held accountable for what they do, because when they do something wrong in a job, people can die.
Jim Sturgis, we had a conversation between two advocates for sort of the continuum of defund the police on the show earlier this week. One of them was Brock Sader, a co-founder and organizer with Mass Action Against Police Brutality. To Renee's point, he said the call is wider than just defund the police. He's really focused on achieving justice for families killed by police. Here he is.
The whole country has to unite behind these families. What is their demands? Their demand is justice. How do you get it? Well, for many of these families, the first thing we have to do is reopen the case.
And you touched on some of this idea in your earlier comments, Jim. Where is the conversation right now, or I guess where should it be, in the balance between reform and justice for past violence?
You know, I guess my fear about this is that I agree totally with Renee when she opened up the show by saying that none of this would have happened without protests. I think there is I'm probably a pretty optimistic guy. I think there's an opportunity for some really broad-based change if folks stay focused on what is absolutely necessary, and that is a cultural change within the police and so-called law enforcement agencies. I think if we go in 15 different directions, I think we lose people, and I think we lose the propulsion behind what is so obvious in the killing of George Floyd. And let me say something. I hope this is not offensive at all, but I would say is what struck me about George Floyd's killing, and there have been many, okay? So it's not like this is, I'm not trying to just focus on one, but if you looked at Ahmaud Arbery, for example, I think people, at least I saw on Facebook and among friends and people that, you know, you read articles, you know, there was this kind of, you know, that's the South, you know, that's happens down there. I think what was so evident with George Floyd was that this is in a progressive area. This is in a place that knows better. You know, there's not perhaps that evident history that there is in the South of letting people get away with murder. At least that's how we talk to ourselves about this. I'm not saying that's absolutely true, but in the case of George Floyd, we watched someone being killed with nonchalance, with three other people assisting watching that, and they felt like that was a permissible action. So I think that the focus must stay, from my perspective, it's only my perspective, must stay on changing policing, because we have a real opportunity there where I think both Republicans and Democrats are all over this. Justin Amash has his bill out there. It's been signed on to by Ayanna Pressley and other folks around getting rid of qualified immunity, which would change the culture dramatically, but it has to be much more than that. It's going to have to go to training. It's going to have to go to who pays for the bad acts of police officers. So going forward, we have a mechanism in place. The police feel like they are not above the law. And again, I have to step back and just say for a second, I do believe that most every police officer out there is well-intentioned, doing really hard work, et cetera, but they are caught in a mechanism, a culture that allows them to, or in some cases forces them to go into this sort of mode of omerta, where they can't say anything or cannot speak out against injustices within the ranks. And I think many of them actually really would like to.
I want to grab a couple of caller voices here because we have so many on the line. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Dave on the line from Yarmouth. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. One of your guests is just asking about police officers in the classroom, and I'm a school teacher in an urban district, and I do have police officers visit my class. In fact, there's a whole program called the GREAT program where they come in for a few classes to speak to the kids, and they're cops from the neighborhood. So that does happen. Maybe it should happen more. I don't know. It would be nice to have it in more to demystify these people so they know who they are. So they see them, they know that they're regular people too.
Thanks for that, Dave. Let's add another voice here. We've got Max on the line from Sudbury. Max, go ahead.
Hi. I honestly really agree with the previous caller in that connection with the community is a really important thing going forward for police, and it's something that we haven't had. And just the attitudes within police, I think Massachusetts and Boston in particular has done a good job on this, but maybe not as well as they could. Just attitudes, really. The feeling that, like, police should be part of the community and not separate from it. You know, like, the people of the community are not hostile to police. And there are, you know, with interviews with police officers, it seems pretty clear to me that they see the, you know, people that they're trying to protect and to serve nominally as like their enemy, as hostiles, and changing that attitude.
All right, Max, let me take it back from you there. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I got a lot of voices to get in, and I got a good sense of your point from the first part there. So, Renee, all kinds of stuff there to react to and build on. Let me just turn back to you.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about what we've witnessed in the last 3 weeks of these protests. Protests which began because of an egregious act of police brutality. And what did we see time and time again? Police brutalizing people in almost every city. You know, what does that say about the cultural rot in a lot of these police departments? You know, it's not just Minneapolis. It's not just Miami. It's not just Chicago. It's all of them. So I think there's something to be said about changing the way police officers train. Maybe there's something to be said about who gets to become a police officer. You know, you have the ability to check people's social media. You have the ability to check what their tattoos say. Find out what these people, as much as you can about them before you give them a gun and put them on the street. You know, I feel like there has to be something done. There's been too many cases. We all saw the story of what happened to the 75-year-old man in Buffalo. And it was that he was pushed down and none of them helped him.
Right. Just for listeners who may not have seen it, he was pushed down by two police officers who were part of a group that was walking against his direction. And when he hit the ground, you could see blood come out of his head and he appeared to be unconscious.
Right.
Sorry, Renee,
go ahead.
You could
see blood pooling under his head. And bystanders were saying he's bleeding and the cops just walked by him. What does that say about how these officers, and these weren't, you know, these were Buffalo officers in Buffalo in the shadow of City Hall who did this. And again, when the two officers were charged, when they walked out of court, they were applauded by their fellow officers. That culture has to change.
Jim, you said that police officers are often sort of stuck or the process locks them in. There has been a great deal of conversation. And in fact, in the 8 Can't Wait platform that the Boston police today, or last night, I guess it was, said that they are going to adopt, it does say that there's a responsibility by other police officers to intervene when they're seeing, you know, a excessive use of force or inappropriate use of force, et cetera. What's it going to take to make the cultural level of change for people to speak up? I mean, it's worth noting that the other three officers in Minneapolis have been arrested on crimes and did not speak up when Derek Chauvin was kneeling on George Floyd's neck.
Right. And look, I'm going to be like a broken record on this. I apologize for it, but I really do think that it comes down to some basic changes around the qualified immunity doctrine, which essentially makes police officers above the law so that there is really no recourse to go after them. The same thing is true in terms of who pays for malfeasance by police officers. If the taxpayers at the end of the day have to pay for that, then there's no real sort of rubber meeting the road in terms of dollar impacts on the police. We have to have the unions pay for it. So they build into their own brethren, if you will, their own interactions, policing of themselves, because those are the things that at the end of the day, we've got to use the money as the lever to open this thing up. Because look, you're talking a little bit before about one of the callers before was talking about the police being best friends. I think we have all traveled, hopefully many of us have traveled to other countries where we see how they police, and probably with the exception of France, which has a police culture that sometimes is similar to major urban cities in the United States. But look, if you go to Italy or you go to even Germany, I mean, these are places where the police relationships are pretty different. You know, you go to the Far East, it's very, very different. And of course, we are culturally so different, and we are a violent society. We have to recognize that we are a violent society. I get that. But there has to be some way to make sure that that does not topple over into a perception of constituents, which is that they are the enemy, and therefore it is allowable to treat them as an enemy. Now, there's a lot behind it. There's a lot that's going on with the militarization of the police, bringing people into the ranks of the police who had formerly been military folks, who are wonderful folks, but however had been trained in different settings and may not be appropriately trained for being police officers. A lot to this conversation. And that's why I'm saying, again, broken record, I'd love to see us all focus on that issue, because that's one where we can make some real progress if we stay focused.
And to be clear for listeners, there has been legislation proposed on that issue in the last couple of weeks. Renee, in a minute, we've got to take a break. The clock's going to make us. Before we do, I guess the last question on this subject, because we'll pivot after the break. What are the other conversations about race and structural racism that we need to be engaged? I know this is a big question, maybe one next conversation on race and structural racism that you think it's time to engage in, that we're ready to engage in, and that this moment creates an opportunity to engage in.
You know, it's one conversation, it's many conversations. Racism has, you know, infiltrated every corner of American society: housing, health, education, policing, you name it. It's all got to be done. You can't do one without doing the other. So I think that people have to look at this as a broader approach. That's why the protests began around, you know, the murder of George Floyd, but it's easily branched out into all these other areas when people are talking about the vast racial inequities that exist in this country, and it existed for centuries.
Still with me are our panelists, Renee Graham of the Boston Globe and Jim Sturgis of the Pioneer Institute. I must be hungry. I almost called it the Pie Institute. Jim, sorry about that. Welcome back to both of you.
We make good pies.
Before the break, yeah, there we go. Before the break, we were discussing policy changes and discussions that have emerged in the wake of George Floyd's death and protests against systemic racism and police brutality. In the background, we continue to march toward a series of elections this fall. November is actually not that far away. We've got the presidency, a U.S. Senate seat on the line here in the Commonwealth, among other things. So how are the current unrest and the ongoing pandemic impacting our politics right now? Pull up a chair, add your voice. How are you thinking about November, the election, voting? What kind of leadership do we need in this moment? Are you paying attention to the U.S. Senate race between Kennedy and Markey? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, I want to first focus on the Democratic primary on the Democratic Senate race between Congressman Joe Kennedy III. He's challenging the incumbent Senator Ed Markey. There was a debate that was broadcast on WPRI 12 this week, and here is what they said about the current state of things and concerns about the spread of the coronavirus in light of massive protests. We start with Kennedy calling out systemic racism as an ailment.
That wound needs sunlight and air. And what we have seen on those streets are individuals in anguish and in pain and anger, the likes of which, look, I will never know.
To have a man murdered, have a brother, a father, a son murdered, requires the level of response which we're seeing in our country. The soul of our country is on fire.
So, Jim, this is a competition for the U.S. Senate. It's a big seat. It's a big role. What do you make of the responses to the moment by Kennedy and Markey?
You know, it's probably the same comment that I would make about the United States Senate. It used to be said that the United States Senate was the greatest deliberative body and had some of the most empowering, insightful speeches that could be found in Western democracies. And I would say that it has always struck me that Representative Kennedy is hardly the orator of the previous generation of Kennedys, and Senator Markey does not really light a fire on anything. And I know this is a, people will take this as a superficial comment. I don't think it is one. What we need right now is someone who can speak with words to inspire us to do something better and to find a pathway forward together. Neither of them seems to me to do that. And I think we're all yearning for that to come from somewhere. I think we know that's not going to come from the president. I don't think we expect it to come from the House. And it's kind of troubling. Frankly, even at the state level, I think many of our officials are well-intentioned or trying to do good things, but there's not the ability to kind of step above all of it and say, that's the pathway forward. And in moments like this, you kind of just need that.
Renee, what's your reaction to that? What would you add?
You know, I think what's interesting in watching these debates is it's become a contest between which one of them is the most woke, right? It's like, you know, he's not a progressive and he's not a real progressive. I think what has happened in the last couple of debates, because of the protests, there's been this push to prove how progressive they are, how which one of them would be better addressing racial inequality in this country. But, you know, I agree with Jim. I don't find either of them terribly inspiring in this moment. And I know that does sound somewhat superficial. But I think that there are real issues here to be dealt with and not this kind of, well, you know, you voted for the crime bill in 1994 and you worked for a Republican district attorney. I don't think these issues are where people are right now. And I feel like they're spending so much time trying to be the most woke that they're kind of missing an opportunity to really address some of the things people are talking about and feeling right now, whether it's COVID, which obviously has not gone away, or it's what's happening in the country right now with these protests.
Let's add a caller voice here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What are you paying attention to in Massachusetts politics right now? Seeing any inspiration, thinking about who you're going to vote for in the fall? We've got Gwen on the line from Cambridge. Gwen, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand the lack of excitement. Ed Markey's delivery style can be somewhat plain spoken. But I feel he has been working for decades. He called for a solar revolution decades ago. He has been working intersectionally on issues of race and on women's issues for decades. And we need his experience at a time like this. And I think people should be mindful of ageism, and I'm afraid that is going to be potentially influencing people. He is working on issues.
Actually,
that
Gwen,
let
me pick it up there. You've made two points there that I want to pick up on both of them, Gwen. So thank you for that call. First, on the ageism, just to be clear for listeners who may not know, Markey is in his 70s. Kennedy is in his late 30s. And also, Gwen talked there about the current issues that Markey has worked on for a long time. She mentioned climate. She mentioned race. One of the things that was interesting in the debate was that both candidates came after each other's records on things like criminal justice reform. Kennedy came after Markey for his support of the 1994 Tough on Crime bill and his initial opposition to integration of the Boston public school system in the late 70s. Markey changed his mind on the 70s on the busing, held strong on some aspects of the crime bill, but mentioned that the sentencing portion of it was troublesome to him. But then there was pushback that Kennedy has not brought much legislation forward that represents anything different. So what about a fight based on records? Is that going to work for the two of them, Jim?
No, I think it's not drawing that much attention because, look, let me be really cynical. I think that Congressman Kennedy is running for this seat because he wants to safeguard himself from a challenge from a progressive minority, and he thinks he might lose. And I think that the hardest question for him to answer is why he's running. Is what he is aiming to do is not that different from what Senator Markey has been aiming to do. And so running on record on all these little fine distinctions, I don't think it's working to engage people.
Yeah, Renee, to Jim's point, I was struck by a column written by your colleague of the Boston Globe, Scott Lehigh, earlier this week. Mm-hmm. I can hear you chuckling. Let me just give a little. It was called, "It's TV's Best New Comedy. Why is Joe Kennedy running for the U.S. Senate?" And at one point he says, anyway, if you're looking for a new series on which to binge, try it out. Initially, it was categorized under political thriller, then mystery. These days, thanks to Joe Kennedy III's madcap performances, you're most likely to find it under comedy. I mean, that's something, Renee.
Get him, Scott. You know, I think I have to agree with Scott to a certain degree. I mean, I think one of the problems I've noticed with Joe Kennedy is he very much reminds me of Teddy Kennedy when he ran for president in 1980 and couldn't quite articulate what he stood for or why he was running. Like, that should be, you know, politicking 101. I'm running for this. And he doesn't really have that. Partially it's because, you know, sort of politically, he and Markey, you know, hewed pretty close to each other. I think that's part of his problem. But, you know, here we are, what, 5 months from the election, and we're not there. He can't quite put it together in what he wants to do. And I think that's really hurting him. In some cases, you know, given his age, given his pedigree, he probably should be running away with this thing. You know, if you look at what happened in 2018 with someone like Ayanna Pressley beating Mike Capuano, there was this sense of we need new direction, we need new blood in the Senate and Congress. And I just don't feel like he's seizing the moment. And it makes me wonder if he really understands or knows what he's doing beyond what Jim mentioned, in that knowing that he could, you know, face a formidable challenge if he stays where he is.
All right, I'm going to shift our conversation on politics here in the last few minutes before this next break. So I'm not going to grab a couple of calls here, but I do want to note that we have a couple additional calls here supporting Markey. We don't happen to have any calls supporting Kennedy right now, but we did have two other Markey calls, and I want to note that because I'm not going to be able to get to them. I do want to shift for a minute to the state GOP. Here in the Commonwealth, because they have made some very specific choices to tack toward Donald Trump. The headline on the website says, "Make Massachusetts Great Again." They have replaced the picture of Charlie Baker, who usually as the governor, the Republican governor, would be the standard bearer of the party, with a picture of Donald Trump. They just lost two of the six remaining seats in the Massachusetts Senate. So four seats in the Massachusetts Senate now, only 31 in the Massachusetts House. Jim, is this, what about that? I mean, is that going to be an effective strategy for Republicans in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
I think effective strategy and Republican Party in Massachusetts are two locutions that have never been put into the same sentence. Sorry. look, this is a sort of a shootout in a lifeboat, and it's unfortunate. I understand. I know many of the folks who are on both sides of that. Like everybody, I just watch in amazement and have increasingly grown just very distant from politics. Even frankly, I'm much more interested in policy. But the fact is, the party has decided that and they're right to do this, I suppose, given how the votes went last time, that Donald Trump will be the standard bearer and they need to support him. The problem is that he is cratering in the polls. This is not the kind of moment that a leader like that can actually shine. In fact, it's problematic. I think if you take a look at all the news sites with John Bolton's book about to go live and some pieces of it coming out, these are going to be troubling times and trouble times for anyone who's behind Trump.
You know, just to add to that point, there's a Reuters Ipsos poll that found that more than 55% of Americans disapproved of President Donald Trump's handling of the protests, and about one third said they approved. And his overall approval rating currently is at 39%. So what of Baker's position?
Can I just add one quick thing? Yeah. Look, there's some polling around after the president said made his quip about looting and shooting, and there was an almost immediate decline of 10 points in his polling, and that some of that really went over to on the Republican side too. So this is not a moment when someone like that is going to do well.
Yeah, and one of the producers just said in my ear, just to make it clear, the president is not accepting those poll numbers, but they are numbers that we have out there. Renee, we do have to go to break in about 1 minute, but before we do, let me ask you, where does that leave Charlie Baker, who is a Republican governor who is beginning to look like a governor without a party?
I think Charlie Baker could look fine. You know, I mean, he's always seemed like a bit of an outlier in a way. He has worked to not align himself with Donald Trump. There's no reason why he's going to do that now. The state GOP is going to do what they're going to do. But I think Charlie Baker has to continue with the stance of distancing himself from Donald Trump, because Donald Trump right now, his campaign seems to be sinking. And that is not something, that is not the boat you want to get on at this moment. I don't see Charlie Baker really doing much of anything, but sort of trying to continue going along as he has.
Massachusetts is now in phase two of our reopening. That means things like retail stores, restaurants, childcare centers can begin to let people back in with certain kinds of limitations. Let's talk about that. I want to kind of ask a different kind of question, Renee and Jim, right off the bat. It almost feels strange to be talking about phase two of the reopening right now. But a month ago, it would have seemed nuts not to be talking about phase two of the reopening right now.
Would it? I mean, you know, the funny thing to me about all of these reopenings, including what's been happening here in Massachusetts, is nobody met the guidelines for reopening. Everyone just sort of decided, well, you know, our cases are dropping, we don't have as many deaths, fewer people in the hospitals, I think we're ready. So it still feels a little arbitrary, you know, and I certainly understand and can appreciate that people want to get back to work. Businesses need to open. This was, you know, economically, this has been an absolute terrible time. But my concern from the beginning has been, if there's a resurgence of cases, which we've been seeing in other states, will you have to close down again? And I think closing down a second time will be even more difficult for people than the first time. So I'm, you know, I haven't done anything outside of just the typical, you know, go to the grocery store sort of thing. But yeah, you know, my barbershop is open. I really need a haircut, but I'm not ready. I'm not sure that enough has happened that will give me the sort of, you know, assurances I need to, you know, get back to any semblance of regular life.
Jim, what do you think? Are we striking the right balance with the pace of the reopening and the data and the lag in data on COVID-19?
So, looking at Massachusetts specifically, I think that overall we've done a pretty good job. The governor's been good on tone. He's not created confusion. But I do think that there are some really weak aspects of our approach. I mean, look, the fact that we are testing up to 15,000 people a day, even at this point, is for me just untenable. We will have institutions of higher education that will be testing themselves alone that number on a daily basis in the fall. That the state government cannot do better than that is astounding to me. The fact that the National Guard is delivering tests to our nursing homes, think about that for a second. That's how we're doing this, really? That seems not 20th century, that seems 19th century to me. Testing should be well beyond where we are if we're going to be data-driven. Second thing I'd say is we have not been following the science in my mind. I think that the fact that we had big box stores that were able to open on the retail side, but not small ones, strikes me as totally unscientific. We basically said to the big box stores, you matter, you're essential, and to the small folks who, you know, are on a cash flow basis in a much tougher position, we told them, nope, can't do that. I mean, I think the same thing is true on graduations and church services. There are plenty of ways to make sure there's social distancing and safety for those who want to attend those things. So I don't think we've approached this over the past month well. I think we started out doing very, very well. I feel like we've gotten overly cautious, not to say that we should be rushing this, but we should have better testing and we should be really trying to follow the science and not just trying to make it easy for folks to police. So
let me grab a couple of caller voices here. Yeah, the lines blew up instantly. So 1-800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Solomon on the line from Dorchester. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. What I'm saying again, I've been around over 44 years, but health, I was a nurse. Health, when life deteriorates after the coronavirus, you don't going to go and come back alive again. They have to think about the consequences, the family, and everybody wants to.
Oh, Solomon, we lost you there. So we lost you there, Solomon. Your sound's coming in and out, but I'm hearing you say we got to think about long-term health. And I know you were saying that we shouldn't rush to open here. Let's add one other caller voice. We've got Missy on the line from Walpole. Missy, go ahead.
Hi. Hey, I wanted to jump in on what Jim said about the small businesses. I have a 51-year-old family business called The Village Groomer in Walpole. And, you know, everybody's been ordering from Chewy.com and online stores and big box stores. And just a shout out to all the small business people. Remember that we're here, the brick and mortars. And also just remember that all the little guys are coming back with all new protocols, a new way of doing business. And we're overwhelmed, but we miss you guys. So small business people, we're thinking of you.
Thanks, Missy. I appreciate that. Renee, we're going to pivot in a little less than a minute, but I want to give you a chance to respond to Missy and to this sort of desire for us all to be understanding of everyone else as we grope our way through this.
You know, I completely hear what she's saying. I miss shopping. I miss going to small businesses. I miss going into places in my neighborhood where they knew me or they would say something. I mean, you can't get that online. It's not possible. At the same time, I want business owners and customers to be safe. And the bottom line is that not every business can reopen right now because they simply don't have the money they need to meet all these protocols, to have the PPE they need, to put up plexiglass if necessary. I just think it's a tough call to make. But I think if there is any indication that the cases start to increase again and we get back anywhere near to where we were in late April or mid-April, then absolutely, it's going to have to shut down again. I mean, you know, I don't want people to get used to the idea that 100,000 people dying is not a big deal. It is a big deal. And if we're not careful, we're going to get to 200,000 before we know it.
Okay, thanks for that, Renee. I do want to leave just a couple of minutes. We usually do hubbubs at the end of Week in Review. Feels like a time for greater introspection than that. So this week, we asked you each to bring a poignant moment, an anecdote, a reflection that's really sat with you over the last week or two. Briefly, Jim, what did you bring?
Well, mine's obvious. A lot of words have been said, a lot of feet of march, slogans, and heartfelt feelings shouted. For me, they all pale in comparison to the moments we saw on videotape when a grown man, a strong man, an adult man, was reduced to begging for his mother because his breath was being taken away from him. That was a moment in which I think everyone felt in their neck the hand of history on it.
Mm. Renee, how about you?
Last week, I had an opportunity to interview a woman named Joan Trumpbauer Mulholland. And in the 1960s, she was a white college student who went to the Freedom Rise and she participated in the sit-ins in the South. And she said something that stuck with me. And what she said is, bloom where you're planted. And what she meant by that was do the work where you are. You don't have to travel. You could do it in your workplace. You could do it where you shop. If you see something, if you see racial inequity, do something about it. Bloom where you're planted.
That's beautiful. I remember reading that in one of your columns last week, right, Renee?
Yes.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So for me, we've really been struggling to figure out how to hold both the pandemic and this reckoning we're experiencing on race in our heads and in our hearts at the same time. And I hear conversations from people about that all of the time. How do we hold these two things at once? How is there even enough room to look at them in full view? And one of the threads that has strung together for me with that is we started in the beginning of the pandemic with this kind of shared experience or rallying cry of we're all in this together, kind of emerged as a way to understand a shared experience. But what I think has happened in the last several weeks is we've just been reminded of the fact that we really have so many experiences that are not shared in America, that we are separated by socioeconomic status, by race, by political fault lines. And the work to do now is to figure out how, as a country, we are all in it together again. So that's my reflection. I sure appreciate the conversation today. Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Oh, come on. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
You too. And callers, thanks for being a part of the conversation today. You're always welcome in the Recon Review. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I am Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and I do hope you'll join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.